Welcome to Service and Wealth, the podcast dedicated to helping military personnel master their finances and achieve financial freedom. Our mission is to guide you through the ins and outs of planning, saving, and investing, and most importantly, how to balance savings so you can enjoy life now and retire with confidence. All right. Hey, welcome back to the show. This is the Service and Wealth Podcast with your host, Ted Ehlert. That's me. And we are rebooting the show. That's right. We're back kicking off season two. We've been off for a few months. In fact, I was just looking at our catalog of episodes, and the last episode published was episode 35, way back on March 2nd of 2025. So the same year, we're not that much delayed. In March, we were planning to go all the way up to the summer. Summer was really busy for us, and we'll get into that in a second. And then the plan was to relaunch in September. And I have to say what we did accomplish in September is we got back to the drawing board, sketched out a couple episodes. We did a couple interviews, and that's going to be a big part of the reboot here in season two is we're obviously... You'll notice straight away we're going with a video format. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, you can head over to YouTube and check out the video version. I don't promise a whole lot in these first few episodes, but what we're going to work up to as we get more comfortable with the editing software is adding graphics, maybe adding some clips, maybe doing some flashbacks, you know, whatever it takes to add a little bit of spice, but more importantly, to add some more content, right? Because so much of what we talk about on this show has to do with numbers. You know, if you're talking about retirement planning, or if you're talking about buying a house, or if you're talking about an investment, comparing stocks, all that kind of stuff, you have to look at numbers. That's what it's all about. Even if you don't like math, you don't even have to be good at math or like math, because you have a phone that can do all the work for you. You have ChatGPT, which can help you out. You don't have to be good at math or know math, but it helps to look at the numbers. And so we're going to add that to the shows as we go forward. And that's part of the reason why we went to video. And we also went to video because we wanted to start doing interviews. And so what we have to look forward to in this season is interviews with different military branches and ranks and points in the career. We've got, so far, we've got, as I said, we've recorded a couple interviews, one with an old guy like myself, guy I've known for a long time in the Marine Corps. And then we also have an interview with someone who's just starting their third year. Well, she's a little bit more than starting her third year, but 3 years out of the Naval Academy. And we had some great interviews. We're really excited. Those will be coming out here in the next week or so. But first, we wanted to just kind of do this announcement. And so the reboot is here. Well, the summer was a long one. We've been off for, I talk about math, but, you know, wow, it's been 7 months since we published our last episode. So basically a half a year off. And while we took a half a year off from the podcast, we didn't take a half a year off from working, from investing, from doing all the things that we talk about here on the Service and Wealth podcast. Now, one thing I just wrapped up after about 6 weeks of work is a complete revision on our book, Service and Wealth, which you can purchase in paperback copy, a paperback format on Amazon, or you can download it as an ebook for your Kindle. You can see it right here. This is the original version. And, you know, I took the time over the summer to reread it. And it wasn't as flowing and readable as I liked. And it had more math and examples in it than I liked. And when you have too many examples and too many numbers, you kind of like distract the reader and get a little bit choppy. And also, I felt it got bogged down a few places in my way of thinking, which is, you know, a little bit overly numbers focused and a little bit too economic and kind of like making things more complicated than they need to be. And so we just completed a 6 week rewrite on this book. We've added two additional, you know, tips or TTPs. The subtitle on the book, for those of you who have read it or seen it, is 10 Money Habits to Help Master Your Finances in the Military, and we expanded it to 12. So we added two more in there. We stripped out some examples. We put some more pictures in there, which, you know, all my fellow Marines will love more pictures. I wish it could come with like a free set of crayons or something like that, but As it is, you just got to buy the book or download the ebook and be happy with that. So we've been doing that. And the other thing that I kind of realized in that process was the importance of taking a step back and taking some time. And the reason why it was a little bit difficult to read and not as good as I wanted when we first published it, gosh, a year and a half ago, I was looking at, we published it in May of 2024, that first edition, is that I had been so focused on getting to the end and getting that book finished and published that I didn't invest the time to make it better. You know, once I had all the content down, once I went through and read it for completeness, I guess would be a good way to say it, I published it. I was so focused on the destination or the objective. And that's only natural, right? If we're in the military, of course, we're always going to be thinking about the objective, whether that's seizing an objective, you know, getting to the end of a training event and doing that final exercise, or maybe it's just making it to Liberty on Friday afternoon, right? We're always looking at the objective, and that's where I was too. And over the summer, I spent a lot of time reflecting, you know, as watching my daughter grow up by leaps and bounds. You know, 6 months ago, 7 months ago, she seemed like a totally different person. And so I've really gotten a chance to adjust my perspective and look at things as the process being what matters and the journey being what matters. And so I made the decision to just go back and kind of take the journey again through the book. And as I read it, I thought, you know, this is not really my voice, and this is not the product that I'm happy with. And so let's reinvest some time, re-engage with the book, re-engage with the audience, think about who's reading it. And I really tried to change, you know, the whole tone and make it more of like a conversation, how I talk on the podcast, how I talk to my friends, my peers, my business associates, and less try to be, you know, writing a textbook. And so I'm not asking anybody out there who's already purchased it or read it to go out and buy a new copy. If you want a new copy and you've previously purchased one, why don't you just reach out to me and I can get you a discount code, or maybe just send you a free copy of the new revised edition. But I think it's a much improved product, and I think you'll really enjoy it. And the additional sections kind of like make it a more complete book, right? Like it's really what started out as this attempt to talk about what the, you know, what you can do to master military finance. It almost should be personal finance at this point. It's much more of like a stepwise guide that anybody can use. It's still directed towards the military, and I added more examples of how military pay and benefits relate to the things that the book covers, but it also can work for just about anybody out there. But what else has been going on? You know, again, it's been 6 or 7 months since we did any work here with the podcast and recorded anything, but we, as I said, we've been busy. And so over the summer, we've done a few things, and number one, we did a flip, so a fix and flip. We finished one rehab on another house, and we're just probably about like 2 weeks done from finishing a rehab on a third house. And for those two, that's going to be part of our BRRRR strategy. And so for anybody out there who's familiar with Bigger Pockets or has heard of the BRRRR strategy, it's all about keeping the house that you renovate. So fix and flip, you buy a house, you fix it, and then you sell it. And the hope is that you make a little bit of cash when you do. When you do a BRRRR, what you're doing is you're going to buy the house, you're going to renovate it or rehab it. So you're going to fix it up, but then you're going to put a renter in there. And once you get a renter in this house, you refinance. And when you refinance, you get to pull the cash out. And a real quick example of how BRRRR works is you can buy a house for, let's say you find a house for $100,000. It needs a lot of work, so you put another $70,000 into the repair. You've got an extra $5,000 or $10,000 of other costs. So you've spent, you know, $180,000 to take this house and make it look new and feel new and have new appliances and a new roof and new paint, etc. Excuse me. And then you get a tenant in there, and let's say you rent it out for $2,500 a month, and you go to the bank and they look at how much it's worth, and now it's worth $270,000, and they're willing to give you a loan that can be covered by the rent the tenant's paying, and they might give you a refinance loan for $200,000. Well, if you do the math real quick, you know, you spend $180,000 to fix it up, to buy it and fix it up, you get $200,000 back. That means you got all of your money out. You even got a little bit extra. In a more traditional, you know, BRRRR strategy, you might get exactly out what you put in, but you know, if you get $200,000 out, that's a great deal. And then what you do, the last BRRRR in BRRRR is repeat. And so my partner and I have that strategy. And so that means, you know, over the summer, we've chugged through two of these, and we're in the process of doing the refinance to go out and do a third one and just continuing to march along. And then we also are, I and some business partners are just on the cusp of signing a contract to purchase a mobile home park, right? Which is quite a big of a leap for me into a new area of real estate, but it's really exciting. You know, I've said before on the pod that I think when it comes to, and let me just quick, you know, interject by saying, in real estate investing, you'll always hear investors talk about their buy box. And that's what that means is they try to define what they do. So they might say, I only do single family homes, or I only buy duplexes, or I only do fix and flips, or I only do Airbnbs. My buy box is I only do things that make money, right? And that might sound a little glib, but what I mean by that is we started out doing single family homes that we bought and rented out and held on to. And then we moved into Airbnbs, then we moved into fix and flips, and now we're moving into BRRRRs and also pretty soon moving into mobile homes. I would like to get into mini or self-storage. They all have similar projected cash on cash returns or returns on investment, whichever number you want to use. And so why limit yourself to that opportunity to have a profitable investment when the only thing holding you back is your knowledge and your comfort? So I look at it as having fun with the challenge of learning new things. And so it's been a busy summer because I've been having to learn a lot of new things, jump into these new projects, manage other projects and older projects. And so here as we finally are settling down into autumn, you know, as they call it here in England, you say fall and they're like, not sure why we're using verbs to describe a season. So we got to call it autumn. But we could also just say it's football season, right? College football underway, NFL underway, Premier League underway. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. Football is underway. It's fall/autumn. And we're back here in the pod. And I thought, you know, there's something else going on in the world today that overlaps with what we've been doing and what we've been focusing on, which is housing and real estate investing. And it's probably a really good time to take a look ahead and talk about housing. And that's something that we talk about in several episodes last year in what is now the first season of Service and Wealth. But it's worth revisiting, right? Because it's a dynamic market. Things are always changing that affect the housing market. And at the same time, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So that's what's been on my plate is real estate investing. It's been on my mind, the housing market, the bigger economy. We're going to follow this episode up shortly with the second episode of this season, which is more focused on the economy and what's going on with GDP and jobs and inflation and interest rates. And we actually recorded it before this one. But as I said, the you know, economic things, they don't change that quickly or that much. And a lot of the things that were bothering us in September are still bothering us now in October. The questions that were here in September are still questions in October. You know, I'll have to edit in sort of like a preview on that episode just because it was right before the Federal Reserve rate was dropped by targeted Federal Reserve rate dropped 0.25% or 25 basis points. And so in that episode, you know, when we recorded it, we're like, hey, we're waiting on this happening tomorrow. What's going to happen? We think this is going to be what happens, and this is what will follow on. And then it happened, and here we are a few days later. So, right. But either way, we're here. And I think that the right reboot episode is not to talk about big, chewy macroeconomic and monetary policy topics. We'll save that for like the second episode of season two. But instead to just kind of talk about housing. It's always on everyone's mind because you need it, right? It's you need a house, you need food, you need a car for transportation, you need electricity, and you need a job, right? So it's like the five things that you need and the five things that the economy cares about. Housing is right there, the sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And so I thought, well, given the economic uncertainty, given the headlines, given what everybody knows and doesn't know or is worried about or not worried about, and the fact that everybody needs housing, that's probably a good way to kick off season two. So here we are, we're rebooting it with season two. And really the reason why this topic makes a lot of sense is that we just got sort of like through this early 2000s, like multi-year period in which housing took off. It took off during the COVID lockdown, remote work transition. It kept going. That, you know, that was 2020. It kept going through 2021 and 2022. When markets, the stock market took a step back in 2022, the housing market kept chugging along. And then late in 2022 and into 2023, big corporations, big employers started calling people back to work. People started predicting the end of remote work, started saying like, hey, all these people who moved to the exurbs and small town and moved from the coasts into the Midwest or the Mountain West or the South, where housing was more affordable and there was more space, fewer big cities, less crime, just better places to live than big coastal cities. There were these predictions that this was going to have major changes or impacts on the housing market. Housing prices were going to collapse, et cetera, et cetera. And none of that stuff actually came to pass. The housing market has proved very stable and resilient. There are plenty of predictions throughout 2024 and 2025 when the Fed held interest rates up, in like the 4.25% to 4.5% targeted federal funds rate. And there were a lot of predictions that this high interest rate would kill the housing market and slow things down, and there would be a collapse in prices. Hasn't materialized, right? And now we have forecasts looking ahead into 2026, and they're being, you know, just as the forecasts for 23 and 24 and 25 were fueled by high interest rates and uncertain inflation, and the predictions didn't really come to pass. You know, now we're dealing with predictions looking into 2026 that have to do with jobs and interest rates and inflation and the economy. And we should take a moment to like really talk about what is likely to happen, what those things mean, and kind of, you know, essentially do like a temperature check or compass check here before we go into the winter and into 2026 and just kind of like, you know, it's almost like taking a knee, right? Like you just got to take a timeout, a tactical pause, and think about what's going on and not get swept up in the headlines or the emotion or doing whatever so-and-so said or copying whatever so-and-so said, but really just like taking the time to think about and talk about and understand how the housing market works and what we could really kind of like predict looking in the future. So, you know, where are we? And what's really going on? You see a lot of headlines that are talking about how the home prices are falling, about, you know, turning into a buyer's market, days on market for homes being, you know, into the 50, 90, 150 days. You know, like these are cherry-picked headlines. They're looking at markets that were overheated or previously hot, you know, things like the markets like Austin, Seattle, those are always the big ones, but parts of Denver, even though Denver's not even really slowing down that much, despite people thinking it should, and other coastal cities, you know, but across the United States, there are bigger factors that come into play than interest rates or economic activity, because the housing market itself is a somewhat, what we would call in economic terms, a somewhat inelastic market, which what that means is that you don't have alternatives to a home, right? If you have to move for a job, if you have to move for school, if you have to move for any reason, it's not like you're going to give up a home and then go live in a tent. Nobody's going to take their family of four and suddenly start living in their minivan, right? People need housing. So as long as there are people and the population of America, despite crackdowns, I guess, in immigration, there's still more people each and every day, week, month, year in the United States, which means, you know, and younger millennials and Gen Z are getting into their 30s, they're paying off their student loans, they have more cash, they're ready to, they're getting married, they're getting ready to have kids. So they're all in like the peak, you know, family or household formation years. And there's millions of them. So there's the demand is what really matters on the one side. And what we can say is demand is always going up in the housing market. Now, the other side of that, for anybody who's taken, you know, econ or AP econ in high school or in college, has taken econ 101 or 102, maybe 201, right? Like, the other side of that is supply. And, you know, the inflation and the cost of materials from mid to late 2021 all the way through 2024, early 2025, really slowed down new home construction and home building and renovations in general. You know, if you talk about any sort of like slowdown in housing, that's where it was. And so for the past several years, we've had a failure to provide enough new homes. So there's been a shortage of supply. Now, basic supply and demand, right? If you understand that we have constant or rising demand, meaning people always want housing, and the supply has been lagging, meaning there's never quite enough new homes for everybody. And so what does that do is that puts upward pressure on prices. And so we can totally ignore the economy. We can totally ignore jobs reports. We can totally ignore interest rates, mortgage rates, inflation. And just within the housing market itself, within this little bubble, we have every reason to expect that housing will continue to be more expensive. And there's no sign of it stopping, you know, especially if there's uncertainty about the jobs market, because that means that there will be restricted hiring by construction firms. If, you know, the crackdown on immigration is going to deprive a lot of the construction industry of workers that are here on temporary or not totally, you know, above board, totally legal basis. But, you know, there's a huge employment pool out there, and that's kind of being reduced by some of the immigration policies that we're seeing right now. And so that's going to make it harder for home builders to get the people they need to build more homes. And so just looking at this sort of as a single industry, a single supply and demand curve, housing is only likely to keep getting more expensive, right? And so, you know, if you're sitting there at home right now and you're thinking, okay, I'm in a PCS next summer, summer 26, I'm PCS from, you know, duty station A to B. And, you know, maybe you already are a homeowner and you're thinking that you've saved up enough cash and you're ready to go out and buy another home. Or maybe you haven't purchased a home before, you're still renting, but you've finally gotten to the point that you're ready to become a homeowner. And so you're contemplating buying a house. Well, what can you predict? I think you need to predict that there's not going to be any sort of like, you know, massive drop in house prices, and the market will at least be stable. You know, we can even look at some of the headlines from the major national syndicates. So you have Fannie Mae, which is the half government, half private, you know, mortgage corporation. And, you know, they're thinking that by a year from now, there will be still growth in home prices, probably be like 1 to 1.1% more expensive. So if we're talking about a $250,000 home, they're getting really wild and going out on a limb and saying like, well, we think that home next year, this time, could cost $252,000, right? Like it's about as conservative as you can get. On the flip side, Zillow is saying they expect home prices to fall by 1%. So they're thinking that $250,000 home will be $247,000 and 500, or yeah, wait, $247,500, right? That's hard to say. I don't know. When you're financing and using a mortgage, that's literally a difference of like $1 per month on your mortgage payment, right? So it's not even worth worrying about. It's not even worth stressing about whether it goes up 1% or down 1%, whether interest rates, that's because of interest rates or jobs or GDP growth or anything else. It's basically saying like housing is going to stay the same. I still think that housing will continue to get more expensive. I would say we'll probably need to look more at like a 4 or 5% growth in average home values between now and October of 2026. Again, that has to do with what I just talked about in the housing industry itself, which is we are going to continue to have more people in this country. People are going to move. They're going to want to buy a new house when they move. And the supply is going to struggle to keep up because of the cost of new building materials and also the availability of people who want to work in the construction industry. It's just going to be harder to get enough people to continue building homes at fast enough pace. So that's my prediction. I guess we'll come back in October of 2026 and we'll see who's closer to the reality. If it turns out that I get it and I'm more accurate than Fannie Mae or Zillow, then we got to do everything we can to get that out there on social media and just show that, you know, like I'm a wizard of the housing market, and then I can become an expert and have my own, you know, I don't know, my own TV show. Nobody has TV shows anymore. I guess a YouTube channel, but I kind of already have that. So I guess I answered my own question. Just publish that on YouTube, right? Which is what we're going to do. So what else do we need to think about then, right? So if we know that houses are going to be slightly more expensive, then the next thing we have to ask ourselves is, does it make sense to buy or not, given what we expect for interest rates? Right? Because interest rates ultimately determine how much you have to pay for that house, because you're not going to be buying it cash. You're not going to go buy a $250,000 house with cash. Some people do, but even those who can afford it are not making the best decision, because why spend $250,000 cash on one house if you could use bank financing and leverage, spread that out and get five houses, right? $50,000 down on each of those five houses. You've made your money go five times as far, and that means you're going to 5x or quintuple your profits on the deal. So let's just assume that you're going to use financing, and, you know, let's assume that you're going to take advantage of a low down payment option. Now, this is something that we're going to talk about a lot going forward as we talk more about housing. And I don't even remember what episode is. I knew I was going to talk about this, so I should have prepped by looking at the old episodes to remind myself of which one it was in which I talked about this. But for you as a military home buyer, you know, your default option is almost always the VA loan, right? If you don't know what the VA loan is, go back. We did an episode on it. We talk about it in our book. The reason why it's your default option is because you're in the military and VA loans are for the military and veterans, and everybody talks about it and you can do a zero down. But what people don't talk about in the military, and you know, I'm guilty of this because I didn't know about it while I was on until way too late, right? Like probably at least 6 or 7 years until after I'd purchased my first home, did I actually know about the FHA loan, the Federal Housing Authority loan. And that's a loan that's older. The program's older than the VA loan. It was created in the immediate aftermath of World War II. It was created for a similar reason, which was to help returning veterans and service members buy a house using financing and a low down payment, right? They just spent the last 1, 2, 4, 5 years overseas fighting. And, you know, even if you're like a corporal in World War II, I'm sure you didn't have that much money. And so the FHA loan was created, and it still exists today. And you can get the FHA loan and with a 3.5% down payment and a 1.75% funding fee, right? So for basically 5% of the house of price of the house, you can use this FHA loan, which is, you know, if you did a zero down VA loan, you have a 2.25% funding fee. So it's a little bit more expensive on a, you know, on a $250,000 house. You're talking about an extra $7,000 or $8,000 that you'd have to save to use the FHA loan. But the second time that you go and use the VA loan, your funding fee gets jacked way up. And so even if the first time the VA loan is cheaper, the second time it gets more expensive. So if you put together, you know, your first purchase and your second purchase, and you do two VA loans, you could, I zoomed my camera. That was crazy. Don't do hand gestures. If you put those together in the long run, it can be more expensive than using a FHA loan your first time and then your second house using your VA loan. And why do you have to do it in that order, that order of operations, as we like to call it? The FHA loan is only for first-time home buyers, so you can only use it once, only use it the first time you buy a house. So, you know, if you're looking at 2026 being the year that you make your first home purchase, don't default to the VA loan. Research the FHA loan and figure out, make sure you're eligible and find a lender who's familiar and comfortable with the FHA loan and go that route for your first home. And then a year or two later, when you're ready to buy again, then come back and use a VA loan. If you are onto your second home or third or fourth, and you still have some amount of your eligibility for the VA loan, you know, consider using a conventional loan, right? The VA loan with the low or zero down payment options is ideal for keeping that in your quiver for a high price, expensive housing market where, you know, 10% or 20% down on a house could be $200,000 or $150,000. Save your VA loan for that one so you can get it for $25,000 or $50,000. When you're in a cheaper market, say a $250,000 average, you know, median home price, that's a great time to use a conventional loan and save your VA loan for when it really counts. But all that aside, you know, let's just talk about financing. And you know, the reality is that the loan interest rates are really quite similar, right? So the big difference between an FHA loan, VA loan, and conventional loan is the FHA and the VA loans have low or zero down payments. And then the interest rates are a little bit different. And so they're not significant. I think as of today, a 30-year conventional is being priced at 6.35%, and a 30-year VA or FHA loan is at like 6.46 or 6.5. So they're basically the same. It's usually within 0.25% of each other. And that's not a whole heck of a lot in terms of your monthly payment. So not too much to worry about, but we're just going to take a look at right now if you go out in 2026 and you're going to buy a house and use a VA loan. Why? Well, because it is the default. It is the most accessible because you can do it for zero down. And, you know, if you're in the military, you probably are going to kind of be pushed that way anyway by your agent or your lender. So now that we've gotten over the sort of the initial obstacle or question mark about the housing market, which is it's probably not going to get cheaper to buy a house if you wait, so you might as well just go buy one. What about financing? And that's where we get to interest rates. Now, here's one of the, this is a big topic, and, you know, we're over halfway into the episode, and so we're going to try to make sure we don't get too long-winded on this, but it's really important to understand interest rates and mortgage rates and how they all relate. So the interest rate is not, and when you see headlines about like Jerome Powell or the federal funds rate, and they're talking about lowering the interest rate, they're not directly changing mortgage rates. And that should be apparent when you see the headlines that the target interest rate is being reduced from 4.25% to 4.5%, like a range, down to 4.25%. You know, that's a 0.25 percentage point drop in the federal funds rate. And then you look across and you'll see, as we just said, that 30-year mortgage rates are about 6.5%. So they're over 2% higher than the federal funds rate. Okay, so obviously when they're talking about dropping the interest rate or lowering the federal funds rate or even raising it, they're not actually talking about directly changing mortgage rates. Mortgage rates themselves are kind of floating, but kind of set by something else, and it's called the 10-year treasury. Okay, and the 10-year treasury is a government bond that our government sells, and the market, let's back up. Our government needs money, and so they collect taxes. Taxes don't cover all that we spend, so we have a budget deficit, right? And in the last several years, on average, our government spends about $6.5 trillion and collects about $4.5 trillion in taxes. I might be off by $500 billion, right? But at that point, it doesn't matter. Like the deficit is still like $1.5 to $2 trillion, maybe a little bit more each year. So how do they cover that? Through debt spending. They sell bonds, which means that they incur a debt. If they need $1 trillion worth of extra cash, they sell $1 trillion worth of bonds. So they get that cash to spend now, but then they have to pay back the people who hold the bonds that $1 trillion over the next 10 years if they're all 10-year treasuries. And that's what we're doing. And that's why you also see headlines about our national debt growing and growing and being now $40 trillion and being, you know, 1.5 times of our GDP and being increasingly unaffordable and unsustainable is because we keep running a deficit each year, which means we have to keep selling more bonds, which means we keep adding debt, okay? And the average homeowner owns their house for about 12 years. Well, that's the average length of a mortgage, right? So if you buy cash, who cares? But if you take a mortgage, the average person has a mortgage out on a house for 11.8 years. The closest thing to that in terms of time that has an interest rate is the 10-year treasury. And so the 30-year mortgage rate, nobody cares about the 30-year part because nobody holds onto it that long. So when banks want to see like how much interest should we charge in this loan, they're looking at the closest thing that they can compare to the amount of time somebody's going to owe them money on that mortgage, which is 11.8 years. So they look at the 10-year treasury. The 10-year treasury sort of moves when the federal funds rate is changed, but the federal funds rate is also not the 10-year treasury. The federal funds rate is what the Federal Reserve Bank charges as an overnight rate to borrow money. And it's more of like today or this year. The 10-year treasury is more a reflection of what the market expects the United States economic outlook or health to be in 10 years from now. And that's why even if the Fed lowers the interest rate, they can lower it again next month, they can lower it again in December, they can lower it 3 times next year, they could bring it all the way down to 3%. They could drop it a total of 1.5%, right? The 10-year treasury is not going to come down a full 1.5 percentage points, which means mortgage rates are not going to come down a full 1.5 percentage points, right? If they're 6.5 now, they will not come down to 5, even if the Fed lowers rates by 1.5%, which is the current forecast. And why is that? Well, because it's a forecast. The 10-year treasury is a forecast of the economic health of the United States for the next decade. And when our national debt is $40 trillion and it's 1.5 times GDP and growing, that means that we are only going to become a riskier investment for people. Buying bonds in the U.S. when we're already in so much debt only gets more risky. It's like if you have a credit card that you have a $10,000 balance on, you're in credit card debt, and you go out and you want to buy a car. You go to the dealer, you put your information, they run a hard credit check on you, and they see you have this $10,000 credit card debt. They're not going to approve you for the best interest rate. They're not going to approve you for the full loan that you want. You might have to pay more. You might have to increase your down payment. You might have to even pick a cheaper car because you just can't qualify for enough of a loan to buy that house. Scaling up, the same thing for that car. Scaling up, the same thing with a house. If now you have a $10,000 credit card bill on your credit report, plus you have a $20,000 auto loan, when you go out and you want to get a loan to buy a house, the banks are going to see you already have all this debt. You're already paying high interest rates on it. And they're not going to give you the best interest rate. They're not going to give you as much of a loan as you want. Scale it up even further, and it's the same with the United States government. The more debt we have, the less people want to buy our debt, the less they want to lend us money, which means the more expensive it has to be to bring them to the table. We're not going to be able to convince, you know, Belgium to buy $100 billion or $1 trillion of U.S. debt at 4.25% because of all the debt we already have. We're getting kind of risky, right? We have a lot of credit card debt. We're not a very good, reliable country anymore to pay it back. So we're going to have to pay Belgium 5% or 5.5%, right? And so when you look ahead to next year, we're not going to see, even if the federal funds rate comes down, we're not going to see a similar drop in the 10-year treasury. We're not going to see a similar drop in 30-year mortgage rates. We might see a 0.5% drop. That's probably reasonable, but not a full one-to-one drop with the federal funds rate. Do we think the federal funds rate will go down that much? Yes, we do. And we think that because we've seen some slowing indicators in GDP growth. We've seen slowing or lower numbers in the producer price index and the manufacturing index. Jobless claims are going up. New job creation is going down. All these things are pointing to a slower economy. And when the economy slows down, it needs more cash. And the way it gets more cash is the Federal Reserve lowers the interest rate. It makes it easier to get cash, makes it cheaper to get cash. And they'll also buy back bonds to infuse cash, right? It's silly. We don't need to go any further into it in this discussion. But basically, what we can say is as we're coming into the end of 2025, and as we're looking at the overall picture of our government's debt load and our big economic trends, you can make a pretty well-educated bet that over the next 6 to 12 months, the federal funds rate will continue to come down to help prop up the economy and try to keep it moving. And at the same time, our debt is going nowhere fast or other than up. And so there'll be continued upward pressure on longer term interest rates. So it's reasonable to say that the mortgage rate's not going anywhere. And so when we say it's not going anywhere, where is it today? Well, as I just said, a 30-year VA loan is currently priced at 6.46%. Now, for those of you who are, I would say, under 25, you probably weren't paying attention to the housing market 5 years ago when those of us who were older and were paying attention were buying houses at 2% interest rate, right? It was really cheap at that point because we had the COVID crash and we had already come off of several years of in the mid-teens of near zero interest rates. So if you bought in the early and mid-teens, you know, like 2010 through 2017 or 18, you know, you were getting like your mortgage at like 1 or 2 or 2.5%. The same thing in like 2020, 2021, even into 2022 a little bit. And then interest rates started to come back up. And until recently, they were in the 7 to 8% range. And now they're down at 6.5% range. Well, if you're my age or you're my sort of like millennial generation, you were in that sort of like first time home buyer or like peak home buying age when interest rates were really low and you could buy a house for 2.5%. And so we are all sitting there waiting. We have an entire generation sitting there in our, you know, your 30s and 40s waiting for interest rates to go back down. It's worth just stopping and taking a historical perspective. All right. So since 1970, okay, so doing the math for you, that's 55 years. 55 years. So that's Gen Z, that's millennial, that's almost all of Gen X. The average 30-year mortgage rate has been around 7%. Okay. So what we have to do is to have that historical perspective. I believe it's 7.19, but 7% is, you can even go back further than 1970, all the way back to the 1950s, basically in the post-war period, post-World War II period, like 80, 90 years, mortgage rates have averaged 7%. So the fact that we're at 6.5% right now, we're actually pretty good. You know, those blips over the last decade when it was 2.5%, that was an anomaly. That was a fluke. That was freak. And we don't really want to ever go back there. Why? Because the only reason why we were there was, one, we had the Great Recession and stock market crash of 2008 and 2009. The housing market crashed, stock market crashed. The economy was in horrible shape. And so they had to drop interest rates. And then we had a massive economic recession and stock market crash for COVID. And so once again, so if you're sitting there thinking, oh, I want a, you know, 2.5% mortgage rate, you're also saying, I want to lose 50% of my TSP holdings. I want to lose 50% of my brokerage, account over there at Vanguard, because it would take a massive crash. it's not worth it, right? Saving $200 or $500 a month on your mortgage payment, but losing $100,000 of retirement savings, it's not worth it. Like, please stop wishing that we had a 2.5% mortgage rate again, okay? The reality is we're in a really healthy, you know, cost of capital is the way we'd say it. Like, pricing of financing right now in the housing market is really healthy at about 6.5%. So how much is that going to cost you, right? So I just ran some quick numbers, right? I said, let's buy a $250,000 house. We're going to be smart. We're going to put 5% down. So we have some equity built in. Doing zero down is a bit risky, especially if you think there's a chance that home values could go down, because then you could owe more than your home is worth. So 5% gives you a buffer. We're going to put 5% down. We're going to pay the 6.46 interest rate on a 30-year VA loan. And on that $250,000 house, our monthly payment is going to be $1,870, all right, $1,870. Well, we think, best case scenario, 30-year mortgage could go down 0.5%. So we'll call it 5.96%, just due to the federal funds rate being lowered by the Federal Reserve and that slightly ticking down the 10-year treasury, but the 10-year treasury is still being sticky because of the fact that the U.S. is increasingly out of control with its debt and is a very risky and semi-insolvent, you know, government at this point. But if it goes down 0.5% to 5.96, which would take at least probably 3 or 4 months from now, so we're already looking into early 2026 for that to happen, that same house and that same down payment, the mortgage rate, the monthly payment on that mortgage would be $1,793, all right? So it would be about $77 cheaper per month. Over the course of a year, you know, that's about $900. $900 is, you know, it's not nothing, right? But it's also not going to make or break the bank. Another way to look at it is, what if mortgage rates actually go up, right? Like, what if suddenly inflation pops back up? And even though, you know, the GDP is slowing and jobs are not as plentiful, if inflation pops up, or if, you know, the federal debt has more of an influence and it actually causes the 10-year treasury to go up and mortgage rates to go up, and we get a 0.5% increase and we go up to 6.96%, right? Which, that's basically what the average has been for 55 to 75 years, right? It's been the average. Well, the same house and the same mortgage and has a payment now of $1,950. Okay. So if that were to happen, your monthly payment goes $80 in the other direction. So what we have here is we have a full 1% range in potential mortgage rates in 2026, where we think, based on the trend in the Federal Reserve and the federal funds rate, we think that rates will drop down to just below 6%. You know, I can tell you that at the moment, there are some predictions from Fannie Mae, again, that they think that by a year from now, they think mortgage rates will be right around 5.9%. And so we tend to agree with them. I think their economists are doing a good job, right? That might sound like a little bit snobbish from me, but I spent a lot of time thinking about it. So I feel like I can have that debate and make that comment. But the range from that versus sort of the other direction of worst case, which is they go up 0.5%, it's a $150 range, right? From bottom to top per month on a $250,000 mortgage. Now, that could be, you know, from best to worst case, you know, that could be like $1,800 a year that you pay or save on the mortgage. But remember what the forecast is for the actual price of the home. The price of the home has got a plus or minus 1% right now. So that $250,000 house, it could be $2,500 more expensive next year. I personally think it will be more like $15,000 to $20,000 more expensive. But even if it's the most conservative and like basically flat and only goes up 1%, it goes up $2,500, which means that the change in the actual value of the house is going to be more than what you would pay in extra mortgage payments in the worst case scenario, right? So if we just kind of balance that out, we're going to get, the sooner we buy a house, the better a deal we're going to get, right? Because the value of the house is going to go up faster then our payments could possibly go up. It's going to make back the value, right? If we have to sell it and we spent an extra $1,800 or realistically more like an extra $900 or $1,000 a year, but the value goes up $2,500, we doubled our money, right? It makes zero sense to wait to squabble over a quarter or half a percent on the interest rate on your mortgage when the value of the actual property is going to more than make up for what you would spend in extra payments at a slightly higher interest rate. And the reasons to just go ahead and buy don't stop there, right? So let's assume houses get more expensive. Even if interest rates go down, which we expect them to next year based on federal funds rate, over the long term, 3, 5, 10 years from now, looking out based on the U.S. debt situation, interest rates are going to continue to go up. It's inevitable unless we have a massive change in policy in this country where we actually try to like balance our budget and bring down the debt. I don't think that'll happen anytime soon, probably not in our lifetime. So you can just assume that 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, interest rates will be higher. It will be more expensive to get a house, and houses will continue to be more expensive in the first place, right? So there's no better time to buy than now. And just to kind of emphasize the affordability of that, let's remind ourselves that in the military, and you don't have to be married, like the way that the rules are written in the Department of Defense for BAH, for the Basic Allowance for Housing, is it basically says that like E6, single E6s and below shall live in government provided quarters, right? So, you know, if you're a single E6, you're actually supposed to live in the barracks. I've actually never seen that. Of course, there are sergeants, single sergeants who live in the barracks, E5s, in case you're a different branch, and sergeant is like a foreign term to you, who live in the barracks. But there's a lot of crowding in barrack spaces. And when you become an E5, even like as an E4, you get to this age and this point where you might be getting single occupancy while the junior enlisted have double occupancy. And that's taking up a lot of space. And it just so happens that if you go out and you buy a house and you petition your command, you know, obviously get the order of operations right. Like you don't want to buy a house and not have the BAH to pay for it and still have to live in the barracks. But you can just be authorized by your commander to move out of the barracks. You can say, hey, I have this house. I want to buy it. I want to move out. I'm a responsible individual. I have the endorsement of my chain of command. So long as your unit commander signs off on it, you can move out of the barracks, get BAH, buy your house, and live in it, right? You now have a residence and you have BAH, okay? But even if you can't or you don't get approved, there's the vast majority of people in the military do not live in the barracks, right? And so you get BAH, which is a tax-exempt or tax-free entitlement to pay for housing. So where are we with BAH trends? Well, in 2025, BAH was raised nationally 5.5%. That's not a very good way to do it because every housing market is local and individual and has different trends. And in some places, you know, the cost of living and rents were up 10 or 11%, but BAH only went up 5.5%. In other places where BAH was up 5.5%, rents were flat or maybe even went down a little bit. But what we do have is we do have data that says they went up 5.5% last year. And the way that Congress has been debating the bill and the way that they're required to index BAH, there's a reasonable guess, you reasonably guess that we'll see anywhere from like a 3.8 to 5.5% increase in BAH for 2026. Now, let's say that happens. All right. If that was to happen, like an E5 or E6, in Virginia, would get approximately a $150 increase to their monthly BAH. An E4 who gets married and is in San Diego or who gets permission to move out because there's no barrack space and has BAH, they will also get $150. If you're an O3 stationed in the National Capital Region, you're going to get about a $150 to $200 increase in your monthly BAH entitlement. If you're a warrant officer at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii, you're looking at about a $200 to maybe a little bit more increase in your BAH per month. In other words, your BAH is going to increase by at least as much as your potential worst case increase in your monthly mortgage payment is going to increase, right? That's because the small changes in a mortgage rate are spread out over 30 years. And so when you get a 0.5% change or a 1% change, it's only affecting, you know, like $25 for every $100,000 that you've borrowed. You can go out and buy a $400,000 house. And if the mortgage rate drops 0.25%, your BH is, well, you're actually way better off. If it goes up 0.25%, your BAH next year will still cover that change. And so affordability is either going to stay the same or get better for everybody in the military because BAH is going up. It's going up. It's indexed to what people are filling out surveys and saying that rents are doing. So rents are going up 3.5% to 5%, and that's why BAH is going up. But if you're a home buyer, the cost of your mortgage is either going to be the same or only go up by like 1%, right? So that's just, it not only makes it more affordable to buy a home for when you're in the military, and looking ahead to 2026, it should be more affordable for you than it is in 2025 to buy a home. But it also is a great reason to get locked in and home ownership now. And why is that? It's because once you take that mortgage out, the payment will never change, right? Once you lock in that mortgage rate, what did we say it was? $70 a month. That's going to be the same this year. It's going to be the same next year. It's going to be the same in 3 years, in 5 years, in 10 years. You could own that house for 20 years and the monthly mortgage will still be $1,870. Meanwhile, your BAH is going up 3 to 5% per year, every year, which means you're getting an extra $150 or $200 a month. 5 years from now, that means you could be getting an extra $1,000 a month and your mortgage payment is still the same, which is all tax-free income that's going into your pocket. So as we kind of wrap up thinking about what the housing market looks like and asking ourselves the question of what should we do as we look ahead? You know, we're planning to PCS. Is the housing market better or worse? Is it going to be more or less affordable? Where are mortgage rates going? Where are interest rates going? You know, we've really covered all the bases, and there's no single reason within any of those why housing will be less affordable for you as a homeowner. It will be less affordable if you're a renter, but as a homeowner, it will be the same or more affordable. Mortgages are expected to be cheaper as we move into the new year. If they get more expensive, it's not by much, but they'll definitely be more expensive 5 years from now. Houses themselves, at the very least, should stay the same, but probably get more expensive and continue to do so. You know, when I was recording the interview with the young Marine lieutenant, she told me about part of that episode that's really cool, is just to kind of hear all the stuff she's been doing. And one of those things was she bought a townhome in Southern California, right? So it is definitely possible to do. And she did that as a second lieutenant, as an O-1, right? So bottom of the rung in terms of income for the officer side, similar kind of income to like E-5, E-6. So a big chunk of the military is making that. And she bought a two-bedroom, two-bath townhome there in Southern California. And she's like, you know, it's crazy because when I bought it and I was, you know, I talked to my parents and they still live in the house that they bought 19 years ago when I was a kid. And they bought that house for like a little over $200,000 and it's over $1 million now. And I was like, well, what does that tell you about the value of your home 15, 20 years from now? And she's like, well, I mean, I can't believe it. But like, obviously, if that's true, like I'm set for life. Like it'll be the single best thing I ever did. And that's the take-home lesson, right? As you look ahead, and especially now that you understand that housing prices are driven by demand for them, by the ability of builders to keep up with supply. And right now, that's only pointing towards more scarcity and higher price pressure. And that as the U.S. economy continues to rack up the debt and have more sort of like monetary problems and fiscal problems, it will only make things more expensive, like mortgages more expensive and other, you know, goods and services and housing more expensive. So the time is right now. If you're going to get into housing, if you want to be a homeowner, the time is right now. You got to do it. You can't wait. 2026 is your year. If you haven't purchased yet, or if you're sitting on your hands, you're sitting on the sideline waiting to do it, 2026 is your year. So what do you do? All right. The best thing you can do is, even on that monthly basis, is not wait. All right. And so we'll wrap up the episode just by kind of like reminding ourselves of what happens and what you should do. Okay. So once you have those orders in hand that you are going to be moving next year, PCSing to a new place, and, you know, assuming it's not Hawaii, assuming it's not Seattle, assuming it's a place where you can afford a home, right? If it's Hawaii, like obviously you're just going to rent. Okay. Cause nobody can afford $2.4 million in the military. Not right now. You know, that's like a $15,000 or $16,000 a month mortgage. So you can't afford that. I just looked, right? I was curious. I was like, I wonder if that's possible. No, it's not possible. Understand the seasonality of the housing market. Okay. Not a lot of people move in winter. Why? It's cold, right? If you hate moving, right? Imagine trying to move all your stuff through a foot of snow or like a puddle of mud in your front yard. Okay. Nobody wants to do that. People move in the summer. The military moves in the summer. So you have like a double demand peak in the summer, June, July, and August in military communities. What does that mean? Okay. Well, that means within this community where you're going, that means there's going to be multiple buyers, multiple offers. Prices are going to get run up. It's going to be in the seller's best advantage to sell their homes in June or July and August. There will be more inventory. That means there will be more houses to move into and more that you can look at and put an offer on and potentially buy because of all those families moving out. But there's always houses for sale. And there's some other tricks you can use anyway to buy them early. And I'll give you an example here in a minute. But what that means is if you want to get a good price on a house, if you want to have some leverage in the deal against the seller, you want to buy it when you're the only person who's making an offer. And that means not waiting till summer. So if you've got orders in January and February, find some time in February or March to take your 10 days of PTAD, your permissive temporary additional duty, which everybody is authorized in the military to do when they get orders. And we call it house hunting leave or house hunting PTAD. But take those 10 days, line it up with your kids' school spring break or just like some time, downtime in the training calendar, and go to your new place. And before you go, contact some agents, get a short list of houses that you're interested in, go check them out, and be ready to make some offers, right? And so what you're going to do is you're going to set yourself up for this position that by like March or April, you could be under contract. And it's going to take 30 to 45 days for you to actually close, right? So if you're going to PCS in June and July, you don't want to wait until June and July anyway, because then you're going to be living in a hotel until September. So you might as well go out there in February, March, find a place, get it under contract, purchase it, actually own it in the spring, and it'll be ready for you in the summer. And the trick that you can use to make this happen for you is something called a lease back. And this is something that, you know, it's in investors know all about it. The average home buyer, especially in the military, has got no clue, but it's a totally normal thing to do, right? You just write it into the sales contract. So if you went out there and imagine this, this is again, like it's going to work to your advantage in a military community. You reach out through Facebook groups and you say, hey, is anybody going to be moving this summer and be thinking about selling their house? I'm moving into town. I want to buy with my family or by myself or my buddy. We'd love to take a look and maybe like, you know, maybe we could save you a lot of trouble if you can find us as a buyer. Then, you know, you'll take the stress out of it. We can like structure the contract. We can either do an extended close, right? Where we don't close it until June, right? But we have the contract in place. Or we can do a lease back, which means we'll close and sell it on May 1st. You're going to get all the cash for the sale, right? So if you have a $300,000 house that you owe $200,000 on the mortgage, when you sell it after closing costs, you're going to pocket like 50 or 60 grand. Well, that can be enough for you now to go and put the down payment on the house on your next duty station. And you have it in pocket by May, right? You're not waiting until June or July or August to sell it or September to sell it and then waiting to put the bid on your house at your next duty station and being, you know, living in a hotel for 4 months while you're waiting. You can have the cash right now and you don't have to move out because we're just going to charge you rent for 2 months. Okay. So you're going to pay $1,000 in rent for May and June. That's what you're paying in the mortgage anyway. So it's no effect on your monthly expenses, and you can stay in the house. You move out in June. We move in the end of June. Everything's golden. You have cash. You've already got a house at your next duty station, right? It's a win-win situation. And if you really structure it right, and you really like do a little bit of homework and get smart, you can actually skip the agents altogether, right? And you can find this, you know, military housing for sale by owner or for sale by owner on Facebook groups. And you don't have to do everything yourself. You can go to a title company and just say, hey, this is what we're doing. Can you please help us out? They have in-house lawyers. They'll do all the paperwork. The only thing an agent ever did for you anyway was try to connect you to a seller and negotiate the contract anyway. So you can help save the seller all of those 5-6% in agent commissions. And so they could give you a discount of maybe like 3-5% on the house, right? Everybody saves, everybody wins. It just takes a little bit of advanced work, right? Now, the final piece of your prep work before you go out there and buy a house is before you even get to the point of taking the road trip or booking the plane tickets to go and jumping on the Facebook groups, you're going to take your total income and you're going to figure out how much of it you can spend on your housing per month. This is a critical step. And where we're going to end the episode today, when you buy a house, you're not going to buy the house that is the most you can afford, right? If you go to an agent and they hook you up with their loan officer at the local bank, that loan officer is going to figure out what the maximum loan is they can qualify you for in terms of dollars. And maybe it's $400,000 or $500,000. Why? Because they're going to get commissions or bonuses based on how many loans they sell. The same with your agent. The agent gets a higher commission for a higher sales price house. So they all want to sell you a higher price house, a bigger house than maybe you want to afford. Your duty to yourself is to keep it within your monthly housing budget. So if your monthly housing budget is $2,500 and that includes taxes and insurance and, I don't know, your HOA, that means you got to keep the mortgage under $2,000, right? And so you're going to need to find a $250,000 or $270,000 house, even if you're qualified for a $500,000 one, right? So the first thing to do is figure out monthly basis how much you can spend on that mortgage payment. And then that's what you're going to look for when you go buy a house, okay? And then, as I said, so the advantages to that are you're not overextended. You are not crushing your budget. You're going to have more free cash to save for other things, for vacations, for a new car, for your next home, for, you know, financial freedom, early retirement, putting in your TSP, whatever the case may be. You're not going to screw yourself over, put yourself behind the eight ball by spending too much on the house. And you also are going to make the exit a whole lot easier, right? When you have that lower price point house, when you move and PCS again 2 or 3 years later, you're going to have a better ability to qualify for a house if you can't sell your house. And if you do want to sell your house, you're going to have that many more potential buyers because, you know, if you are, let's say, an 04 and you buy that $500,000 house, it's probably out of reach for all the 01s and 02s and E5s and E6s coming in. But if you are a little bit more disciplined, buy the $265,000 starter home that you're only going to live in for 2 years anyway, there's going to be a bigger pool of buyers when you want to exit and sell, which means you're going to get multi-bid situation, higher selling point, right? Higher selling price. So better for you on the way, all the way around. You can tell we have been talking for an hour here because I'm starting to stumble over my words and it's just inevitable. You can only talk so much before you need to take a timeout. But I think we covered a whole lot of really good content today. I think it was a great way to start our reboot of the podcast, Service and Wealth, and kick off season 2. I want to end the podcast by saying thanks to everybody who's been supporting us. I'm sorry we've been away for 7 months doing other things. We've been doing big things. We've been doing good things. We've been reinvesting here in the brand, in the content, and now we're finally back at it, putting out new episodes. We're happy to be doing it, excited to be doing it, and the next step here is to grow the community, to bring more people in so that they can get the same kind of insight and, you know, just get smart, boost their financial IQ, like know what they're doing with their money, master military finance, become, you know, eventually financially free, right? At the very least, have control over your life and your situation and your time and your money. All right, guys. Thanks. We'll see you next time. Thank you for spending time with me today. I know how busy life is in and around the military, and I don't take your attention or your time for granted. It really means a lot to me that you're here, and that's why I pour so much of myself into each episode to make sure it's worth your time. If today's episode helped you, here's your challenge. Share it with a battle buddy, friend, partner, or someone in your family who could use this information. Together, we're growing a stronger, smarter, and wealthier military community. For more resources, tools, or to sign up for a free coaching session, head over to www.militarywealthcoach.com. And you can also find us on LinkedIn and Facebook by just searching for Military Wealth Coach. Follow us on Instagram and X at MWC112358. Our groundbreaking book, Service and Wealth, 12 Proven Money Habits to Master Military Finance, has just been revised and expanded for 2025, and it's available in paperback and Kindle on Amazon right now. And stay tuned for our next book, The Ultimate Military Retirement Plan, your standard operating procedure to financial freedom. Hey, until next time, stay financially fit and mission ready.